Hello, this is Kyle Jones. Last week on Job Part 1, we covered the first chapter of Job as being historical, literary, consular, and hagiographic. Though our main focus was on the historical, we also tackled some cultural and linguistic nuances. First, we established the Hebrew formulaic, Ish Hayah, to mean the man that came to be, as poignant historical. Secondly, Uz is known as Ossus in the Septuagint or Ossetity and is geographically concentrated to Idumea and northern Arabia. Thirdly, the Hashatan or the Satan as a titled Satan and not necessarily Satan incarnate. This Hashatan was reflected 1,000 years later as a Neo-Babylonian / Persian executive officer. This Hashut was a special officer within the ranks of Cyrus's Tur Sinai, end quote, or, quote, sons of interrogation, end quote. This Hashut in the Chiropadia, which means Cyrus's education, was documented in Xenophon's Chiropadia. The Persian Aramaic holds title called the roving eye of the king. This is the Hashut. Furthermore, this means for us, basically, the CIA for the king or the CIA officer for the president. Tonight, I will use the literary approach for analysis of Job. The piece of work that I would like to contrast and compare Job with is Shakespeare's Macbeth. Though Job is inspired, literary devices used here are only tools for gauging the greater work of the Bible. I in no way am trying to reduce, nor could I reduce, the Bible to a mere literary great. In contrast, I honor the Bible as Book of Books and the divine voice of God through its literary genius. Let's begin. Both in Job and Macbeth have a literary mechanism called reversio. Easy enough to remember. Its meaning simply is to reverse the theme. Macbeth's three witches held the Mater Noster, if you will, the Our Mother in Hell, of fair is foul and foul is fair. This is a mantra that was first stated by words with the witches in scene 1, later felt in subjective flow. This theme of consistency, that is, the reversio of foul is fair, fair is foul, is called the antimetaboli, or anti, against, meta, reversely, and baleen, to throw. The phrase that begins this counterchange or antimetaboli in Macbeth is, like I have stated, fair is foul, foul is fair. In Job, reversio began, I believe, immediately, because it already happened before it was written down as historical fact. The story itself is then what we call pluperfect, meaning this, a completely accomplished event that affected other historical events that are now completely accomplished themselves. But the transition of thought through the natural discourse came through in word and deed by Job's first wife in the story, and later Job's three friends. Both spoke for the Satan through the doctrine of legalism, dispensed by Job's three friends. As compared to Macbeth's three witches, they too spoke for the nature of temporality and its necessity to carry on the biological need. They were the voice of Hecate, the great diabolical feminine spirit. The witches spoke for the contract of fortune and all that fortune brings. As to mode of operation within the doctrinal theme of the two stories, inversion of principles is the thing. That is to say, grace is denied, Grace is defined in the Greek as unmerited favor or unearned favor. It's the Greek word charis, from where we get our word charity. It means to give without expecting anything in return. The antimetaboly phrase, good is bad and bad is good, reverses charis, or grace, as the dominant theme and substitutes charis for its antitheme, which is legalism. Legalism takes on the doctrine of assumed prima causa or prime cause for the subjective and objective assault on Job. In comparison to this, Macbeth is bound to the fated natural progression without mind. This is true literary predeterministic fatalism that generates a hope of eternal now and denies all rights for looking at temporality's end for what it really is, namely death. Death by inversio is the prima causa now. Death as logos and its doctrine is absolute in its formulable essence for the story's sake, but in reality could never work as a generator of the physical or spiritual. The genius of Shakespeare's Macbeth is that death works as a generator. For my students, notice I did not say Shakespeare's genius, rather the story breeds a genius. This implies a touching of the divine in Shakespeare's play. In this genius work, it is genius as a sub-creation in that it is literary. For a universe could not build upon itself with natural progression based on these, quote, death by temporality, end quote, principles, as we will see further. But by Macbeth's formulable essential context, literary predeterministic fatalism, and are tried as true, and true is tried as literary doctrinal theodicy. A doctrine of death as deity and dominion. A fatalism that Satan must agonize with in the real world sense. This is a potent aspect of Macbeth as device and counter-reflection to Job. The three friends' premise for Job's scrutiny was a reflexive doctrinal theodicy of the Satan. As Satan said in Job 1, verse 11, touch all that Job has, and Job will curse you to your face, God. This satanic theodicy, or subsumed theodicy by Satan, claims its negative grace by saying, quote, since good rewards those who do good, well, then inversely, if you take away, Job will have affectation to be bad. Since this interfactio is status quo for this playing ground of literary work, then number one, reward is good and not necessarily given from good. Number two, bad is status quo for not having anything in the temporal world, or should I say having any possessions of temporality. This makes A its own right, and the badness of B is not tangent on A. Therefore, the equation has no effect or cause, and the elements in this reverse equation are their own status quo, and cannot be equated nor summated. The elements became their own cause. Object is now subject, and by this law, all things stop now. Since the very act of movement itself is reflexive solely of another system, then, therefore, the interfaction or playing grounds system of existence produces a literary equation of causality that becomes a, quote, nothing that is, end quote, and a, quote, nothing that is not, end quote, scenario. The same is applied for affectation. For the rules of affectation, or the affecting thing, require causality. Both causality and affectation are working synergistically for a, quote, nothing that is and is not, end quote. This reversal of logos as a literary badness and anti-logos as a literary goodness creates a reversal of scrutinies. This puts God on trial as destroyer, Job as devil, and accusers as holders of judgment, and finally, death as deity and a literary generator of all things in this theodicy of reverse. The good indictment against Reversio's equation is that the power that brought Reversio to hierarchy is the sole mover. Even though Reversio's evil is truly a detrimental evil and a reverse logic, morally or physically. In contrast to this negative grace, quote-unquote, demigod, death as archon, the laws of grace have a reverse correlative cause and effect between a transcendent God and temporal man in their tangent relation. The pivotal and tangential interfactio is a device in the middle of our literary equation to express confluence on the two distinct existences of death as ruler versus gracious sovereign God as ruler. It is the earthly realm of natural and amoral activity, that means without moral, good or bad, that becomes the interfactio, if you will, the litmus test field. This literary device, that is, the interfactio as playing ground, can be used to show the negative grace theme that Shakespeare has come upon by approaching the laws of grace. Satan says, "Touch Job and all that he has, and Job shall curse you to your face, God." Well, historically, as touching of Satan goes, in comparison of historical facts to literary means, we have in Macbeth a Satan spelled S-E-Y-T-O-N. This Satan, being the armor-bearer and messenger to Macbeth concerning Lady Macbeth's suicide. For historical complement, the history of the Satans, as spelled S-E-T-O-N-S, were called in Scottish history as the, quote, Satans of Touch, spelled as former. They were, and are still, the hereditary armor-bearers to the King of Scotland and to the kings of Scotland. The peculiarity of choice in Shakespeare's naming his personal messenger and armor-bearer adds dimensional richness to the literary dimension, that is, the metalogue imagae, or mother stuff for imagination. We have metalogue plus imagae, etymologically speaking, the mother stuff of imagination. Hence, the word metalogue, if you will, is where we get the word material, the mother stuff. The historical Satans of Touch are too close for comfort to be of an innocence in the interplay of Shakespeare and his entourage. Furthermore, this inversus shadows that of Romans 13, verse 12, 2 Corinthians 6, verse 7, Ephesians 6, 1, and Ephesians 6, verse 13, as instruction to the Christian warrior to put on the armor of God. In the equipping of Macbeth with an armor that is worn to be his fatalistic and decimated end. Furthermore, this armor cannot be penetrated by temporal men or of woman-born men, quote-unquote. Only until the fated and final battle with Macduff, the man not of woman-born, will Macbeth see his fated end. Ultimately, Shakespeare's device leads us to the portent of Genesis 3:15, that is, the fated serpent's final assault on Christ's triumphant coming. As Macbeth is to the Nakash, or Satan, in the Garden of Eden, Yahweh spoke to Satan concerning Satan's end by the Messiah, So does the witches announce the portent, or the end of future, of Macbeth. By this, Macbeth knows his end. Still, as Satan of the Garden continues his fated journey to his final destination, Macbeth himself in full battle array against the Burning Wood, that is, the triumphal army of Scotland, to Macbeth's own destruction. The temporal affectation, or affection, by default of the natural and temporal reader, that would be you and me, is divisive for the subtle test in both stories as to whose side the reader is on. Because it is a natural inclination to want to rest in the riches of the world. Both stories, Macbeth and Job, warn against this natural affection. Both stories warn of the math of natural desire and natural thinking. The natural evocation is to ask, is it not so easy to take Macbeth's side as well as the wife of Job concerning success in real estate ownership? Once again, both stories use the seemingly innocent view of stuff and things to actually be good. And so it may be. But good isn't the problem. Both stories show that good things become the focus. I say again, the good things become the focus. This idolatry becomes subjectively more obvious in Job as the three friends and Job's wife view the loss of temporal things as a natural satanic act. And I say again, natural satanic act, not moral. This view is also inverted, that God is not in control if Satan is naturally acting out. And by this premise, God would not be sovereign if this is the case, but rather an agent of chaos and diminution. Both Macbeth and Job were undeservingly given a fate. For Macbeth, a common foot soldier, the fate was his end. In Job, the fate was the undeserved punishment. But the sovereign grace, which differs from fate, both saved Job from fate, held Job together as doctrine, and was the salvific divine expression of God on Job. While Job carried grace as his weapon against the trial, Macbeth became the fated one, who was divisive in the trial against Job, the Job character Macduff. It was Macbeth who fulfilled the prophecy as Satan of Genesis 3:15. That is, the serpent whose head was bruised while bruising the heel of the Messiah. In Macbeth, the Messiah figure. Interestingly, this messianic figure found in Macduff supersedes that of the pagan's hero title. This supersessional term, man not of woman born, or the semen dispenser of hope, not to receive but to give and procreate, gives a refreshing sense of the new hero in literary terms. This old biblical term, son of man, now becomes complemented in a newness of literary meaning. As the Hebrew custom is to carry on the name of the man, we have this custom in the heathen's line of progeny as well. Taking the higher ground, that is, the spiritual, Jesus was always as he was, and never did he have a temporal mother in his fullness of majesty. It was only the flesh on Jesus that was of woman born, that is, of Mary in the physical sense, and this woman-born man, Jesus, suffered and died, but not the essence, not the spirit. The essence is the same in all who have identity in the fullness of Christ. Job, spiritually, was not of woman born due to his rejection of receiving and giving based on another's work, or his own work. Yet, in Job chapter 14, we see Job's speech concerning the temporality and sureness and destruction of being woman born. As the Bible is its own glossary, I use the Bible for the standard for all terminologies. Job states the laws governing the title of woman born as follows in Job chapter 14. Quote, man born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and is cut down. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. End quote. This passage continues to set the power of limitations for better definition concerning the title, quote, man born of woman. End quote. Please read Job 14. In contrast to Shakespeare's Macbeth, Macduff, due to his mother's breached birth, held a contrasting title called Not of Woman Born. This title was brilliantly established by Shakespeare to physically mirror the fated hope of a righteous ruler to come and end the satanic rule of fatalistic causality and its temporal and spiritual destruction. In our literary term, this means, quote, to destroy the satanic inversion or metabasis of fair is foul, foul is fair, or good is bad, bad is good. End quote. The potency of this literary inversion puts Satan as, quote, son of man, end quote, in position versus Christ as, quote, son of man, end quote. Such title carries a horrific line of destructive hope, which I see as an ingenious work of Shakespeare concerning this, quote, negative grace idea. Please see my Logeia CD concerning receptive versus giving theodicy as theoretical doctrine. This literary contrivance of Shakespeare, though ingenious, is only a reflection of the greater story concerning this line of Satan versus, quote, line of Christ, end quote. The three witches of fate carried Macbeth out to his destruction by the deception of the temporal hope. That is, the hero's, quote, limited immortality, quote, end quote. And once again, hear my CD on Loaf and Dome concerning the hero's temporality hope. Macbeth took on the feminine form of receiving what he could in the temporal world from the Fates or the Weirding Sisters, while Job took undeserved punishment and stripping away of his temporal possessions as divine love from God for Job's betterment. The specter or shade Satan in Job did not destroy Job, rather was the device that brought Job to a more blessed status. The shade specter Hecate in Macbeth gave Macbeth his riches instantaneously and destroyed him in the end. These are two different outcomes, the sovereign ruling either way. As Reversio stands, the table is tossed upside down. All temporal things fall that were on the table, and other temporal things can be placed on the flip side of the table. Either way, temporality is affected in this table tossing. One thing is not, grace. Grace is the key element in Job that cannot be reached as cleanly in Macbeth as it can in Job. Job's beginning theme after his four major calamities was this, quote, does not God give good and not evil? The point being, Job knew, believed that God was in control. He was the true dispenser of riches and the taker of things. Both stories had a specter. Hecate for Macbeth and Hashatan for Job. Job had three friends who scrutinized Job for past, present, and future relations with God. They scrutinized Job as a failure to meet the needs of high legality. This legalism of love is the position of attack that Satan used against God's position of grace that God had handed to Job. This attack is voiced by Satan and carried out on Job through the three friends, whom Job later calls as evil. This correlates with the legal contract of the witches of Macbeth. Grace is preached in Job as the constant factor of God's love. In the end, grace is shown to be the only vehicle to God. And in grace, God unnaturally or naturally, God can express himself to mankind. The key to this study is this. Grace holds together no matter what literary or spiritual inversion takes place. Grace unnaturally ascends to its throne when all things literary, linguistic, and historical are turned topsy-turvy or simply done away with. Grace is the unnatural language that we must learn. Otherwise, we miss the language of dialogue that God has for us and we have for Him.